We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders, journalists, politicians, sports people that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. For regular listeners, you will know I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself called PocDoc. Our flagship product, the Healthy Heart Check, is now the number one diagnostic product across the UK, the nation's most popular health check. It delivers the equivalent of the NHS health check in just 8 minutes. You can find it in any high street pharmacy. And if you'd like to go to our website to learn more, you can. It's pocdoc.co, so pocdoc.co. We work extensively with the NHS across the UK. And if you are lucky enough to be in one of those NHS regions, you may well be able to access it for free. Feel free to ask your GP or your local clinician to see if you do. And thanks as ever to PocDoc for supporting the show. So it's great to be back doing a live show. It's been a while. Obviously, we went off on our summer hollybobs. And today's show is with someone that we've been trying to get on the show for a while, and now the stars have aligned. It's Dan Vedat, who is the CEO and co-founder of Huma. Now, Huma have been around for a few years, but they are widely regarded as one of the shining stars in the firmament of UK health tech or digital health. So Dan, obviously we can go through it with him, but they had a fantastic COVID, I think it's fair to say, where the UK government and the NHS relied heavily on them for their digital platform. And they've since expanded globally. And it's just a fantastic opportunity and an honor to get someone like Dan on the show. So Dan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much, Steve. It's fantastic to be part of this program. I guess before we start, I love to know more about PocDoc. What kind of tests and screenings do you do?
Yeah, we can. Let's get into that at the end or as part of it. But we really focus on cardiovascular disease prevention. We actually just launched our diabetes health check last week, which sold out. The first batches sold out within 24 hours to the NHS, which was super exciting. So it's all smartphone based,
like biomarkers for this.
Yeah, so it's blood based biomarkers, okay. Integration with the NHS risk engine. We integrate with the patient record, really trying to increase access to the health check, CBD health check, diabetes health check. So we're very lucky to work with over 30% of all NHS regions so far. So it's great. But we can get onto that. We can get into that afterwards, because it would be great to get your thoughts and insight on that. One of the things that I should have done at the start of the show is to say thank you to everyone listening live on UK Health Radio. It's great to have you here. And thanks to everyone who's downloading this or listening to it on any of the podcast platforms. We get downloads now in over 50 countries every month, which is mind-blowing. So thank you so much for joining. But Dan, let's start with what are the origins of Huma? Like, how did it kind of come to pass, and what was the environment, the health technology environment, the digital health environment, the landscape like when you kind of got everything together in the beginning?
I think the inception and the start of the idea came out of some simple observations, slash some frustrations, slash some, I guess, naivety that I had at the time when I was studying at Johns Hopkins, but also doing part of my PhD research in Oxford. And because of that, I was exposed to spend some time at John Radcliffe in Oxford, amongst other places, next to kind of myself growing up in a family of doctors. My father is a cardiologist, my sister, she's a gynecologist, and so on and so forth. Into a simple understanding that we know quite a lot about patients when they are in hospital, when they are next to the doctor, when they are on the bed, in ICU, CCU, emergency room, and so on and so forth. But the same patient, a few days later, which still they might be struggling with their condition, still they might be deteriorating, as soon as they leave the four walls, we know nothing. And at the time, this is now 2010, 2011, when I was thinking about the whole thing, mobile was new, iPhone, it was just the beginning of iPad, and we didn't have any wearables the way we know it, Apple Watch and so on and so forth. They started in 2016, really. And my kind of belief at the time was, what if we can bring the data flow and the visibility that we have about the patient, a simpler version of it compared to what you can get in the hospitals in their home? And that is how Huma started, with this vision that, can I know more about you? And by knowing more about you as a patient, can I be more proactive, predictive, and maybe pick up things before you're too sick that you have to rush to hospitals, or in some cases even you may die? So that's kind of what we started with. And then soon we realized the only way to fulfill this mission, given healthcare is sensitive, given healthcare is complicated, is through technology, right? And this is why the mission of Huma has always been, how can we accelerate adoption of digital and AI across care and research? Simply because by doing that, you basically solve all the good stuff that we wanted to solve, directly or indirectly, one way or the other. That's what we have been up to since, 10 years now.
And how closely is that vision aligned to the problems that you initially saw during your PhD? By the way, I was actually born in the John Radcliffe, just to let
Ah.
you know. I'm a local boy from that area. But how has that evolved? Because what you just explained there was a really, really exciting broad vision, but there was so much in there. Like, I guess another way to think about it is sort of, did you focus on a specific, very specific problem or area or clinical sort of intervention or research area to begin with to kind of prove it out?
Yeah. Yes, we focused a lot on rare diseases. And the thinking was, technology still new. No one was taking us seriously anyway at the time. And the only hope we had was, could we find a cohort that they would really benefit from what we want to do. Rare diseases are a good, they're a good cohort because the numbers are not big, the cost of the care is high, so there's extra attention and bandwidth for each. They often live far from their centers because in each country you have two, three centers of excellence that they can really get care. And these patients, because of the backgrounds of rare diseases, which is mostly genetics, they're young often. And most importantly, they have suffered a lot until they get to their diagnosis. So they're a little bit more engaged than typical diabetes patients or typical asthma COPD patients per se. So this is how we started, not knowing, this is where the naivety kicks in, that when you pick one disease, you may only get 100 patients. And 100 patients in a country, you might not be able to have any business.
Yeah, but I so I mean, we're a digital medical device manufacturer, and I always say that, like, if I'd have known, like, genuinely known the difficulty, I probably might have made different decisions, but actually, like, that naivety at the beginning, I think, is actually quite helpful. In a way, up until you get confronted with reality.
I do agree with you, but I think my case even worse than yours because when I was at Johns Hopkins, lots of my professors, they were like entrepreneurs in
Oh,
health
cool.
tech, med tech, and so on, and they all told us stay away.
Did they?
Yes, like do not get into it. It's just tough. And although I had this collective wisdom of all these amazing people, I kind of, I guess partially my stupidity at the time, I ignored it and I entered into a journey of suffering. Yes.
So what was the first, because yes, you focus on rare diseases makes sense. They're identifiable, they are limited in number, they're engaged with their own health m significantly more so than the average, and maybe even more so than chronic disease patients. What was the hypothesis that you were trying to prove with them, or what did you prove, or what did you show? The benefit of the technology was X.
So the whole idea was these people, they go home and then lots of stuff can go wrong because most of the time they also are comorbid given the how rare diseases usually they impact your health. And they have all sort of complications that could be connected. And if you can avoid one earlier, then you will avoid all the subsequent like domino effects that it may have on your overall health. So the whole idea was simple. Can I keep you the most optimized version of yourself? Yes, you have a disease. Yes, maybe you have some genetic kind of disorders and conditions, but still within who you are, the way you are, by being proactive and predictive about your symptoms and how these drugs, impacted your overall health and side effects and so on and so forth, and certain vital signs, can I have an eye to keep you the most optimized version of yourself? And that's kind of how it started. The answer is yes, the same way that, if you want to go to the world of normal people, if you have a good coach on top of you and you're training, they keep you more optimized and you usually don't injure yourself as much. So it's kind of a more complicated version of that for a patient with rare diseases and some doctors on top of them. That's what we really focused on.
And how did it go in that first, like, it can't have, I'm sure it went well because you went on a journey, but it can't have been completely perfect either, right? Or rather, what were the big learnings that you got from that first sort of set of rare disease work?
I think one of the biggest slaps was you can build something that you think is great, but people may not adopt it. And people may not adopt it for a variety of reasons. One is obviously maybe patients don't feel there's enough value and they don't get enough delightfulness out of it. Or it's just not convenient for them for all sort of reasons. I think we got lots of punches on that part. then you may have something that patients love it, but then the hospital's management, because they are ultimately the ones that they need to decide whether they want to implement the solutions like that or not, they feel it's just not necessary, or there are lots of procurement concerns on the process side or security side, data side, that makes the whole adoptions hard, even if you have, return on investment. Then you have the doctors and nurses. They're like, okay, I'm like doing these new things, but no one is really paying for it for my time, right? And that's like a big problem. And at the beginning, we were like, oh, these doctors are so inhuman, they don't not like. And then as we matured, we realized, you know what? Any human, you have a limited time. You have all sort of responsibilities, and you have to prioritize. And the exchange of money is really important. We go to work partially to make money and also partially to make impact. And sometimes we overvalue the kind of contributions we have, and we started kind of judging it and telling, oh, these doctors don't get it, or these nurses, they're not, so we got a bunch of punches and learnings and from those. And then I think I also commented on the fact that, with 100 or 200 or 500 patients, you won't be able to make a business in the world of technology. It's quite an expensive space. And then we had to build, something that we can scale it to other diseases, but it's not easy to build, solutions for each disease from scratch. So we had to solve a lot of technological challenges. So collectively, we embarked on a journey of mistakes after mistakes, or experiments after experiments, pivoting after pivoting, almost across everything. Because also what we were trying to do is like pioneering. Like, nobody did this kind of stuff at the time. Nobody even believed this kind of stuff would work.
What out of interest, just on that, what was the biggest what when you say they said it wouldn't work, what bit were they referring to? Because a lot of what you're saying has now been completely accepted conceptually, right? And even if it hadn't have been, the idea of helping people to be more optimized, to stay out of hospital, to deal with their disease better, like none of that is completely bonkers. So what was it when they were like, nah, that's not going to work?
To give you one example, for something that we all relate to, autonomous driving. For years, everybody was talking about it, but also everybody was so sure that it's so complicated and every road is different and people are weird. And, there are lots of challenges, whether day, night, no one is going to be able to do that. And then until somebody really did it, still no one truly believed that is possible. Although there was this focus that it's gonna happen, but now it's there. You can get into taxis and they just drive themselves. Same for us. Almost every aspect of what we wanted to do, Steve, from the fact that mobile phones, they have no place in patient care. I have emails from really nice people, CIOs of top NHS trusts. At the time that these are gadgets, they will never ever can be utilized within, NHS, as just one example.
So good.
These kind of data, no one is going to rely on it, or patients, they're not going to spend time on it, or even if you get all these things, they're not going to get adopted or integrated. Good luck. NHS has spent 20 billion to integrate things to each other as they failed. This is, 2010, 2006, 2007, that era. And they were right? From one perspective, they were really right. But from another perspective, I think they didn't fully appreciated that it is not Dan or Huma that is going to make these things possible. Is actually an industry, and the change that is happening in the world is going to push us. And Dan and Huma might benefit from this transition and transformations that's happening on how we react to the world around us. You know, if the iPhone didn't exist, if all these sort of apps like WhatsApp and Instagram and others wouldn't be around, probably they were really right. Because no one would have used mobile phones, especially older populations, which are kind of like most of our kind of customer base. So that's, I guess, what people missed, the wave that is coming. They were correct about our ability, but they were very incorrect about not seeing the wave. And we were talking that we are going there, and they would look at us and they say, like, no way. But they didn't see that we're gonna ride the wave.
That makes
That is
sense.
important.
Yeah, so one of the other examples I like around that is, have you heard of a business called Shazam? You know,
Yes.
Shazam the app.
Yes.
So one of the reasons I feel so passionately about what we do at PocDoc is that when I was 14 and my dad was the same age I am now, he had a huge stroke due to undiagnosed cardiovascular disease. It was catastrophic for him and for the family. And he was out of the work. He was out of work for a really long time. And previously he'd been in and around VC-backed telcos around the birth of the internet. So before the dot-com crash, after the dot-com crash. And when he came back into the workforce, the only job that he could get was he was the first CEO of this failing startup. There were three MIT founders that had got this great algorithm for song tracking. They'd raised $1 million in Series A. They did $1 million Series A, which even if you apply inflation is still a pretty small Series A. And that was the only job my dad could get as the first CEO. So he was the first CEO of Shazam, and took them from pre-product launch right the way through launch and et cetera, et cetera. But right then, when they launched, you had to type 2580 on the old Nokia phone, right? So that UX was horrendous. And then you got an SMS with just the name, like you couldn't even buy the song because there was no digital songs at that point. You couldn't do anything. It was a gimmick, kind of, right? Up until the iPhone, at which point the App Store connected into the music stores, connected into et cetera. Just the whole thing just took off.
I didn't know actually it started so early. Interesting.
He had me like, I did all my work experience or some of my work experience as a kid in their offices. They didn't have label deals, so what happened is that they needed like half a second of the sample of the music, but they obviously needed a reference library. The labels weren't talking to them because the labels viewed that as copyright, so they wanted to get paid, and they didn't have any money to pay them. So they were just like ripping CDs off for a really long time, like, and just sampling them that way while they were trying to figure this stuff out with the labels. So it was really, I mean, it's always quite personal, but that's the thing I refer to where it's like the product waiting for the platform.
And you know what you say is really important, and I think there is this misconceptions in the world of entrepreneurs and startups or anybody that I launch something today and tomorrow it has to be successful. But then, you know, to give you one example, and I use Palantir because lots of people call Humo now Palantir for healthcare. You know, when you look at Palantir, it started in the year 2000, right? So it's been 25 years.
Is that right? I didn't know it was that old.
That is correct. And most of their success, it's been in the past 18 months, really, in terms of the growth. And now they're like quite mega cap company, but they were like 10, 20 billion, but now they're like almost close to 500, half a trillion. And then when they got started in 2000, it didn't start like ordinary people. You know, you had Peter Thiel and Alex Karp and these people that they were somebody at the time. And it took them, you know, 25 years. Most people don't appreciate to build great stuff. It takes a long time. Same for Shazam. I think probably took 20 years until Apple, I think, acquired them, probably.
Yeah, it was a good 10, 12 years from, no, longer than that. Yeah, no, it would have been, I mean, yeah, it was probably 20 years from the point at which they developed the algorithm for sure.
Yes.
No, I think it's, but I agree with you. I think it's. I don't know whether it's like the social media culture or people. I think are very focused on success and seeing success and then not understanding the journey, I think. But anyway, we will dig into, because I want to kind of bring stuff forward a little bit to talk about since those beginnings, how you've gone on to really expand at a huge rate and be referred to as the Palantir of healthcare. So we will be back after this short break with my guest today, CEO and founder of Huma, Dan Vedat. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hi, welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, CEO and founder of Huma, Dan Vedat. So Dan, you gave us a great kind of overview of the beginnings of Huma and the why and the problems you were solving. But you very clearly said a couple of times, it's very difficult to build a really big business off of very low patient numbers. So what was that transition? What drove that transition? How did it happen? What was the next phase? Give us some, you know, walk us through that.
So, you know, as soon as we built the first app, we were like, okay, this is not enough. And we knew kind of with one patient cohort, we can't do much. But we said, you know, we're going to do multiple of these and then it will be good. And then when you get to three, four applications, with especially small team, even keeping the applications updated and, you know, the logos. And the
so did you actually have different apps for different conditions and stuff?
That's correct. Yes.
Oh, wow.
They had different names for each app, each disease.
And were they medical devices or no?
No, at the time, there was no medical device concept for apps.
Okay.
We were, I think, the first company, I think, we called both FDA and MHRA that, look, we are working on this kind of stuff. Shall we do something about this?
They're like, wait, what? What?
Exactly. and this is like more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then we realized it's like impossible to maintain this. And we said, you know what? Let's try to make the whole applications configurable for diseases. And so that each time we don't need to build from scratch. And that worked quite nicely for us to some extent, because then we could easily, you know, move few things, configure few things, and then boom. We have an application for this use case or an application for another use case. And that helped us to scale to 20, 30 diseases in a single right. hospital. I think at the time it was Royal Free NHS Trust that we did a lot of work with. And big part of Huma's success is really tied into their support and commitment into innovation with us. I think Will Smart was the CIO at the time. Caroline Clark was CFO. And then I think she became the CEO at the time. And a bunch of other amazing people under them that they were like really happy to invest. Small amounts, but still invest and experiment and let amazing clinicians they had to play with kind of these new concepts. That is how the evolution happened from, you know, a couple of apps to something that you can actually launch different applications. And then that was the beginning of our journey to thinking, okay, if we can build every rare diseases, more or less, with a little bit of, you know, maturing of the platform, we should be able to support every disease, because rare diseases are often the most complicated one anyway. So if you can do rare diseases, you for sure can do more general diseases. And we embarked into the next chapter of the company just to discover all the problems in that chapter.
Yeah. And then, so just a second, with these rare diseases, the 20 or 30, so by the way, I know Caroline really well. She's amazing. Caroline Clark, love you if you're listening. Like, you rock.
She's awesome.
Yeah, she's the best. She's a great person. So with And she's been really helpful with PocDoc and expanding nationally and things like that for us. So but when you with the 20 or 30 diseases in a hospital, right? That's a significant amount of work for you guys, right? That's 20 or 30 different disease pathways. Each one's got tons of gates, decision trees, clinical oversight and stuff like that. Were you getting like was it overwhelming or like just the day-to-day of that is immense just with one hospital?
The technology part wasn't overwhelming. The part that hit us was, okay, great. You set it up, you built something, and these doctors, they had rare disease, specialist nurses or whatever, because they got some extra funding somewhere, and they could allocate these persons to track these people and interact with them, and things are good. But then suddenly that funding would come to the end, and then there's no one to man the platform. And because there's no mechanism for reimbursement of anyone's time, so most of those initiatives didn't really go far, simply because you can't have the best car if no one is there to drive it. No passenger goes from A to B. Probably, and it's really hard to just leave the car to the passenger and say, you know what, you drive
Well,
it.
I think that's one of the things that I mean, I've learned from working in the NHS, working with the NHS, that I think it's worthwhile kind of expanding on for everyone listening, because we are a broad church of people listening. Is that the way a lot of NHS funding works is very project based, which is what you're sort of saying, which is we've got a certain amount of money to give Humor to build a digital clinical pathway for remote monitoring or however you would refer it for a particular disease. But there's no guarantee of that being an ongoing, even if the results are great. There's no, there isn't much pathway after a phase one sometimes, unless it goes into like standardized procurement, which is not often the case with innovative tech.
That is correct. And also, you cannot have a standardized procurement for everything.
No.
By inherently, when you get to procurement, you're already killing lots of innovative stuff.
Yeah, because you've made it too generic and much, much, much too big.
And also a lot of tick boxing, which lots of companies won't be able to adhere to, lots of, requirements and governance and certifications. For small companies, that becomes extremely difficult. But also, these are like medical use cases. Almost someone has to treat them like a drug rather than a software, I would say. And this is where, when you enter into the zone of technology overlapping with medicine, this is a very dark zone because you don't. That medicine people don't want to pay for it and look at it that way. Technology people don't really understand it, nor they feel the need. Because if I have an EMR, it is an EMR and my patient's there. And if it's not there, I got to stop. The maturity is there, but the maturity is not there for new technologies that are add-on.
No, and the issue becomes, right, with something that's referred to as a therapeutic, then the medicine people will be like, okay, cool, I'd like to see your clinical data, your randomized control trials, we'll assess it like a drug. But drug discovery is extremely well funded,
Yes.
because it has to be, with extremely clear pathways of growing, baby biotech into medium biotech, into big biotech, into big pharma, so that investors can make very informed decisions. And it's all completely, I mean, it's almost completely transparent actually about these things, which doesn't really happen or hasn't. It's very difficult to take that approach with a digital therapeutic, because the order of magnitude of funding that's available in those pathways is just completely different. That's my take on it. I don't know what you think.
That is correct. And this is also why we don't really have that many digital health companies that are doing something meaningful at the scale. R globally, I'm talking, by the way, even in the US, although the dynamic is much, much better than here, still, there are some challenges on the size of reimbursements and the mechanism and what it takes. And almost every digital health company is just confused between whether they should be a technology, whether they should have a service element, whether
Yeah.
they should be therapeutics, whether they should be consumer-based. And that has been a big challenge in our industry. And you compound that with the complexity of building digital health company because you have to be a tech, secure, scalable, all the good stuff. You can't go wrong, you know, this
Yeah.
is mission critical. You have to be regulated and everything. And then
Yep.
you also have to comply with all these like rules and certifications and requirements on data governance, GDPR, sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly you have a very expensive machine with a long sales cycle, multi-stakeholder kind of processes without a path to monetization.
Yeah, or without a sometimes a clear path, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so how did you guys sort of navigate that, or how do you personally feel about that? Because that's something that the things you said there are sort of consistent with what people talk about in the industry and things like that. But, you know, how do we deal with it? You know, how do we fight that? How do we maneuver around it? What's your thoughts?
So we actually thought really long and hard about the whole thing. Given our exposure, you know, across the board, and also given the opportunity we had to act as a platform company, not by choice or by design from get-go, by just what the requirement of these rare diseases pushed us to become, right? A
Yeah.
lot of people, they look at us and they say, oh, you're like a Palantir for healthcare, so configurable, you integrate with all the stuff coming in and you can build things very fast. You guys are so genius. Like, how did you come up with it? I'm like, dude, you have no idea. We did not come up with this. We had to build it that way. And then each time we really like added some extra capability to it to solve problems of, you know, the customer base that we had and to deal with those. When we look at the whole industry after thinking really hard, we were like, you know what? It is possible to make money. It is possible to create, you know, sustainable businesses, but you got to be very careful about your cost base.
Yeah.
And if you treat your company like an enterprise software company or a pharma company or biotech company, your cost base won't add up to what you will gain.
No.
I think that was one part. And then the other part, which goes back to the complexity of our industry, because when you want to sell to hospitals or life sciences, doesn't matter, you don't have one stakeholder. You have to talk to the IT, you have to talk to the CFO and or finance, you
Yeah.
have to talk to the medical team, regulatory team. And also there are lots of politics in big organizations like that, as you know. If you become big, they say the bigger you become, the more dumb you become as an organization. You won't be able to navigate all these nuances of different stakeholders and so on and so forth. And it leads into building a very big team, lots of layers to be able to serve all these use cases. But because the system that you have built is big, can't really maneuver. And that's why we fundamentally thought, besides technology innovation, that you have to build a platform that you can, you know, do things 10 times faster and cheaper. And without that,
Yeah.
good luck. You got to come up with a different operating model. And this is where I have, you know, introduced this new operating model. I don't know if you've heard of it. I sometimes say it's like a cat versus lion
Okay.
model.
Let me stop you there because we're going to go for the final commercial break, and then let's talk about cats and lions after that break. So we're going for our last commercial break now of this week's show with Dan Vedat, the CEO and founder of Huma. We will be right back.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, for the final part of our show with Dan Vedat, who is the CEO and founder of Huma. So before the break, Dan, you were talking about cats and lions and your new operating model. So I cannot wait to hear the analogy of cats and lions.
So after thinking a lot, we realized you can make money and these monies can add up to at least 10, 20, maybe 30 million ARR. Per use case, if you're patient enough. We don't know how you grow that use case from 30 to 300, but to 10, 20, 30, we know because we had some initiatives like that. Then the question was, what are the things that are making the whole delivery and maintaining that 10, 20, 30 million revenue expensive, which makes it unsustainable? Because if you make 20 million and it costs you 30 million, that's no good business. And that's kind of most of digital health companies today. We said, you know what? The tech is really important because the tech can be very expensive. Each time you have to build from scratch and maintenance and this and that, and developers are expensive. That's one part, which we addressed it through Huma Cloud Platform. Then for a lot of use cases, you have to have regulatory approvals, you know, class 1 or class ideally 2, FDA, EU, MDR. If you're global, then you have Japan and Saudi and this and that. We thought about, okay, what if we can build our platform that each time you launch something new on top of it, you don't need to go through the whole regulatory process, running, you know, studies and all the good stuff that you also hinted on, because that takes a long time, at least 2 years, but also a lot of money.
Huge amounts of money.
And third one was like, can we operate as a small company in a big company or in a bigger company? Can we operate as a small company? Because as a small unit, one person, the person in charge, can actually navigate a big customer or a specific disease. As long as they have all the right tools and all the right support, so that they don't get distracted with technology regulations and HR and this and that. So to be able to do that, so we have reduced massively the cost of development, right, through the platform. Yeah. We have reduced the time and the cost of regulatory through getting, you know, umbrella level regulatory approval for certain use cases. We said, you know what, let's break Huma to 10 pieces. Because we are doing different diseases, right? Rare diseases. Yeah. We are doing, in some cases, some geographies. And we put a CEO for each unit.
Okay.
And by doing that, suddenly we reduce our ops team, commercial team, customer success team. Each of those, think of it as a bucket of 30 people for the entire company, to 10. So 90 people became 10. So the 90 people that they were supporting all use cases in a very complex enterprise structure, which most companies operate that way, you know, Salesforce operates that way and so on and so forth. But because they charge a lot, it makes sense for them to operate that
way. Yeah, they can do it that way, right?
Exactly. And they don't have complex stakeholder base like what we do, right? Doctors, regular.
No, and also like Salesforce's market is like everyone. So it's a pretty big market, right?
That is correct. So, and then we said, you know what, we put one person in charge of this project. This person has access to our technology, has access to all our shared services, legal, regulatory, finance, HR. And if that person's business grows, they can hire a few more people as it grows. And then suddenly, Steve, a business that was, let's say, making $2 million a year ARR for us and would have costed us $3 million a year to deliver the 2 million became like 400K cost,
right,
but still making 2 million.
Sure.
The growth of it wasn't as much as before, but still I'm making 1.6 million profit
Right.
from something that I was losing money. That is good. And then when we realized the model is good, we expanded it. Now we have almost 20 units operating
Right.
that way. These units, they go, from 1 million ARR to 20 million ARR each. And then the reason I call this lion versus cat, it's like, if a cat chases a mice, that's a good food for the mice, for the cat. But if the lion wants to catch the same thing, the energy it takes to
Yeah.
catch it, it's not worth it,
And the
right?
payoff is very low.
Exactly. And that was what we used to be. We were like this big machine wanting to catch this like a little project here and there. And that's not good. And then also the other problem happens when you have customers and situations that you make less money than what you make, you will say yes to deals that are inherently not good.
Yeah, you're up against the wall, right? You have less leverage, or you feel like you have less leverage.
Yes. And people then abuse you, or you put yourself in a place to be abused. Right now, if the projects, someone comes to us, doesn't have the right profit margins, we say, you know what? No.
And how much of your business is now outside the UK? Like, what's that? What's international look like?
So most of our business is outside of UK, although we have a very big presence in the UK. The whole UK healthcare market is so small
Right.
on technology side. I don't think the whole UK healthcare on the technology I'm talking, right? Tools
Sure.
that digitally touch patients and so on, excluding EMRs and legacy stuff, it's more than even 100 million.
Oh, really? The
Yes.
total for digital, pure play digital, you think? Wow.
That's correct. It's very small. If you add up, I think the
There's a
revenue,
lot of companies in that space as well, right?
I know it's a dogfight. It's
A
really
real
a dogfight.
dogfight.
And most important danger, I think, in that dogfight is most of the products that are fighting for that 100 million, in some use cases, us included, they're not even companies or products. They're features. We are features
Right.
in some cases. Features on top of EMR because the EMR, eMIS, or System One, or TPP, or whatever, they were like so shit,
Yeah.
didn't have the right features. And this is why, certain companies could get some space around, patients.
Yeah,
Engagement.
because you can innovate quicker, or they can innovate around them because those companies are so slow
That
or
is correct.
disincentivized to change.
That is correct. But we are still feature.
Yeah, right.
Feature can turn off because if they come up with an equivalent feature and do it a little bit cheaper, they're gonna win. And
Yeah.
that, how the whole Microsoft has been killing it. Microsoft killed the Slack, not
Right.
because Microsoft, Teams or messaging is better than Slack. It's just when you have Microsoft portfolio of Azure, it just makes sense. You just
Well, or like, I mean, it got shipped free with Office. Like, what are you going to do?
for sure.
Like, I mean, like the penetration of Outlook's pretty high. I don't know what it is versus like what's the next is Gmail the next one probably for like offer for work. I mean, I don't know. I know a few companies that run
Probably
off of Gmail.
90% are Outlook
Yeah.
enterprise.
But no, that makes yeah. So do you feel like and based on what you've seen in other markets, is that same setup around features, companies, products, legacy, is that there or is it freer and more open and more innovative?
In other countries,
Yeah.
it's a lot more innovative. In US, totally different, because you can survive as a feature. You can have
Right.
features. Features will die because they're, a lot more agile. And if they see an opportunity to capture more revenue, they go after it.
And is that because of the way the system has been set up conditionally, financially, or commercially, or operationally, or is it about the culture or a bit of both, or
Both,
what is it?
both, both. And that is why we said, you know what? For us as a company to have a path, we will really become the infrastructure for everybody, us included, to build applications. Some of those applications are like standalone, solid ones, some of which could be features, some of which we built it, some of which other people will build it. And this is where the transition of Huma from a product company or a platform that had set number of applications that we would distribute, we would sell to a true platform company, kind of Palantir for healthcare, our customer now they call us. That us, our customers, two people in a garage, one big pharma or two doctors can go in it, and you can build an EMR on top of our platform today.
Oh, wow.
Of a country that is building an EMR, a national EMR for the country on top of Humacloud platform. You can
That's
build a
cool.
national app, like what NHS app does. Think of it a, equivalent of that for a couple of other countries. They're building their national app on top of us, while they also use our other configurations or use cases that we have been, as a
Yeah.
legacy functionalities we had. And here and there, we also come across companies and we say, you know what, that is nice. Let's acquire that company and bring that to Humacloud platform and make it available to all of our customer, not too dissimilar to what Microsoft does with Azure strategy. You sell the platform and then you can start with one functionality or one product. And then slowly, when you have sold that, every other product is there. You just have to turn it on. Your consumption goes up. And that is how we evolved into, I guess, this new chapter of the company.
That's super exciting. How we've only got a few minutes left in the show, but I've got one question, and then we've got 2 minutes left in the show, apparently. So I will skip my other question and go to my last question. So I ask everyone this: when times have been difficult through your career at Huma or before, what is the kind of internal motto or mantra that you rely on that you would like to share with people that might be in need of a boost listening to the show?
I think the most important is to keep the hope in a personal level up, which the only key to that is through sport and doing, exercise. Without that, I think no one can survive. That would be number one for me. The second motto or the second driver is just, we gathered some amazing people at Huma. That's our biggest, achievement. My biggest achievement is the people at Huma. And I fight for them because they believed in this, and I believe in them, and I want to fight for them. And that's kind of the second driver. And then the third driver is, when you put, all the glamours of the world, if you are in an industry that what you do, is cool for the society, and you can say, you're doing something, positive, right? No one can say, oh, you're, hurting anything. Psychologically, I think puts you in a place that I'm actually doing one of the best things someone can do in their life, and there is nothing better than this I want to do above and beyond, and that also gives you another, I guess, connectivity to stay hopeful and focused on building something huge and impactful for yourself, for your team members, for all the people in the world.
A fantastic place to finish the show. Dan, thank you so much for coming on.
No worries. Thanks so much for
And
having me.
if people want to learn about Huma, where do they go?
I think the best place is our website. We have launched a new one and LinkedIn.
Okay.
And following us on LinkedIn, we post the stuff here and there. We don't talk too much about what we do, to be honest, because we believe in kind of enterprise word of mouth,
Right.
but people should reach out.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And thanks to everyone listening. We'll be back again next week with a new show.